primary source readers represent an unusual historical genre. Unlike editions, their aim is not to enable the reader to hear as clearly as possible, or as completely as possible, the voice of a single historical personage or institution. Nor are they purely interpretive works in which the author's voice is foregrounded, such as a monograph. In this conversation with Princeton University historian Anson Rabenbach, we learn what methodological, but also what moral challenges faced him and co-editor Sandra Gilman in crafting the Third Reich sourcebook, which appeared in 2013 with the University of California Press. In this interview, we learn how they selected and how they decided to preface the voices of Nazi ideologues, politicians, fellow travelers, and their victims. With 411 primary documents that take the reader systematically through the key cultural fields and criminal activities of the regime, the sourcebook represents a major engagement by two leading intellectual historians with the Nazi worldview. They found this worldview less uniform and internally consistent than others have surmised. Beyond the exaltation of the German folk and the demonization of Jewry, much was up for grabs, including the epistemological framework meant to ground these core concepts. In this interview, Rabenbach paints a picture of German intellectual life under the Third Reich that was contradictory and complex, yet above all, impoverished. Hello, and welcome to another podcast with New Books in Intellectual History. I'm your host, Todd Weir. Today, it's my pleasure to speak to Anson Rabenbach, who is a historian at Princeton University in New Jersey. And together with Sandra Gilman, he has recently edited the Third Reich sourcebook. For those listeners who happen to be familiar with the Weimar sourcebook from the same press, University of California Press, this is an equally impressive work of scholarship. I've counted, there are 411 documents, mm-hmm. primary sources, and there are, I think, 21 sections, each with its own introduction. So it's a very important book, both for German history, but also for intellectual history. And I'm sure it's a book that we're going to use to teach German history for many years, and students are certainly going to go to it for material. So, Anson, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You're a very eminent intellectual historian. You've worked on Weimar. You've worked on post-war history. You've certainly written some essays, I think, on the Nazi period.
That's right.
But this, I assume, is your most substantial work on the Third Reich to date. Is that correct?
Well, that's correct. I did publish in 1976, actually, an article called The Aesthetics of Production in the Third Reich, which was actually planned to be a book on the beauty of labor, which was the organization devoted to modernizing and improving factories and factory labor in the Third Reich. And I did a lot of research for that, but it ended up as being part of another book, which was called The Human Motor, which came out in the 1990s.
So The Human Motor, as you just suggested, was a project that led you into some of the questions that probably were of interest in this book. Can you say a bit more about what led you in the more recent years, I suppose, to this particular project?
Well, after I published The Human Motor, I began a project on the humanities in the Third Reich, on universities, academics, and intellectuals, which actually was published as a book called Nazi Germany and the Humanities, which I edited with Wolfgang Bialas. And it was based on a number of conferences that we organized, actually three conferences that we organized on the subject. So I'd been working on the humanities, universities, intellectuals, academics for some time before I conceived of the idea of publishing a source book, a comprehensive source book about Nazi Germany. I felt that a source book of this kind was not only necessary, but had really never been attempted before. There are, of course, source books, and we can talk about those, but a comprehensive one like the Third Reich source book had never been attempted. And I spoke to the people at the University of California Press, especially Ed Dimmenberg and Martin Jay. And we thought that it fit well with the Weimar Sourcebook. It was a sort of natural end, so to speak, to the sourcebook collections of the University of California Press.
A question about the sourcebook as a particular genre of historical inquiry. And it's quite different, obviously, from an edited edition of a philosopher's work or of an institutional history. And at the same time, obviously, it's not a monograph, but it lies somewhere in between. It's very time bound in the fact that there is an editor who puts it together with his or her particular interests and so on. For that reason, I was curious if you could maybe say something about how you maybe viewed past source books. I'm thinking, for instance, of George Moss's collection from the 60s on Nazi Germany. There's a more recent one by Richard Breitman with the German Historical Institute in Washington on their website. How you were just beginning to say about what makes this different, but could you say something about then how this particular work is different from, say, those other ones?
Well, let me say first that I was a student of George Mossy. I studied with George Mossy in the 1960s and 1970s, and at that time he had just made the transition from being a historian of the Renaissance and Reformation period to the modern period. And his book, Nazi Culture, which was the first collection of documents of this kind, appeared in 1964. And it was really a pioneering work. It was the first book to treat the Nazi period as having a distinctive culture and ideology. Before that, it was almost assumed that Nazi culture was kind of an oxymoron, that there was no such thing as Nazi culture and no such thing as Nazi aesthetics, art, literature, film, that these things, that Nazism was opposed to those things, was the destruction of culture rather than having its own distinctive culture. And Mossy's book was very influential. It's still in print, by the way. But it is, I think, seriously dated. For example, there's nothing about the Holocaust, nothing about the destruction of European Jewry in the book at all, which seems to me to be a great lacuna. But if you think back to the 1960s, it was the time when Raoul Hilberg was publishing his destruction of European Jewry, and there was nothing, there wasn't the degree of intellectual and scholarly work on that period that we have today. So the book is certainly dated. It's a little weak, I think, in its conceptualization. And there are a number of factual errors in the book. I mean, every book has factual errors, but some of the documents are misidentified and so on and so forth. By the way, I should add parenthetically that I asked George Mossy, who was a close friend of mine, if he wouldn't like to be the third editor of the Third Reich source book, and to contribute not only his vast knowledge of the subject, but also some of the documents from Nazi culture, from his original Nazi culture, for our book. Mm-hmm. But he declined. He was getting on in years, and he didn't want to do another project of that magnitude.
Sure.
Let me say something about some of the other document collections. There are a number. You mentioned Richard Breitman's. There's the German Historical Institute website. I find that particularly wanting, that website. It has something like 100 documents, which is a very small number of documents. And also, there's very little about culture, very little about cinema, very little about radio, very little about popular culture in general, and almost nothing about the history of the body, sexuality. Things that we focus on in our source book don't exist on the German Historical Institute's website. It's a very conservative, I don't mean politically, but in terms of methodology, a very conservative selection of documents. There are also several older compilations. Jeremy Noakes and Jeffrey Pridham published a four-volume collection of documents in the 1970s and 80s. But that collection, it seems to me, is narrowly focused on social history and also has really has no substantial introductions to the sections. Let me add finally that the best online compilation of documents, to my mind, is the Nazi propaganda archive of Calvin College. It's organized by a scholar called Randall Bitework, and he has a fantastic collection of documents, texts, also images, very, very good on posters, very, very good on advertising, all sorts of things. There's not much interpretation, but there's some. And I should add that he was very cooperative in our, in working with us on our book, and we did use some of his translations for our book.
Good. You know, I was mentioning before we began the interview that when I received this book, I was very excited when I had it in the package and so on. And then my point of reference in the excitement was really the Weimar source book, which has these fantastic sources from, you know, the many of the philosophical, you know, inspirations, I suppose, of the 20th century,
sure.
as well as, you know, of course, many Nazi texts from the 20s. And 30s, and then when I opened this book, immediately see the red, white, and black. You know, the color of the Prussian flag, the Nazi flag, and then this large Third Reich emblazoned on the front. And I started to feel a little bit of anxiety about it. In a sense, I started to feel really the burden, I suppose, of these sources before I even opened the book. And then in your introduction, which I think is quite important to talk about, you go into this you know, perhaps what was producing the feelings of foreboding, but you compare the Nazi period to the Weimar period and the Weimar source book to this source book. I thought that was very interesting. Perhaps you could say something about that to open up for the readers a bit of, you know, what your intention was as an editor.
Well, the thing that links our book to the Weimar source book, apart from the chronological connection, is that the Weimar source book was meant to be a kind of comprehensive picture of that era, and to document to a large extent the richness of the period. It contains countless documents by the philosophical, artistic, literary, musical greats of the Weimar era. I mean, think of Adorno, Brecht, Krakauer. I mean, these are the kinds of figures one finds. So there's a kind of, certainly a kind of richness, a kind of canonical and legacy of Weimar that's presented by the Weimar sourcebook. By contrast, the Nazi era is about the impoverishment of culture. It's far more monochromatic. And there are very few exceptions to that. I tried to include whatever exceptions to the this monochrome. The problem was to deal with the monochromatic character of this era and to find ways of presenting the Nazi era so that the texts themselves, although they might be boring and superficial and ideologically wretched, also provide a certain kind of tension, a certain kind of interest that one doesn't have to work to achieve in the Weimar sourcebook. For example, one of the few intellectuals of real note and real substance who made common cause with the Nazis, and there were many. I mean, one thinks of Heidegger and Schmidt, but I'm thinking specifically of Gottfried Benn, the writer who for a brief time embraced the new order and the new era, as he called it, was in conversation with, wrote letters to Klaus Mann, Thomas Mann's son, who was already in exile in 1934. And we included that correspondence. And I think that's one of the best illustrations that we have of the tension between the Weimar era and the Nazi era in that encounter.
Yeah, I mean, I was really struck by the in the introduction where you very directly addressed this, the problem of the poverty of the culture of the Weimar era, and
the Nazi era.
Of the Nazi era, and you stated
right.
That really your core undertaking was to reveal how narrow and parochial the intellectual concerns were of that particular era. And then you also had another lovely quote, which was that your translations even had to, quote, capture the surface dullness of Nazi language while revealing the inner tensions of this shifting ideological morass. So very biting commentaries and very strong statements, editorial statements, in the right in the beginning about you know, how you approach these sources and the entire project of an intellectual history of the Nazi era. Can you started to say something about the tensions between the in this case the Gottfried Benn and the Klaus Mann. I'm just curious about how this undertaking of attempting to show both the poverty of the culture, but also some of the tensions, how it worked itself out in the choice of texts. Did you exclude things that you thought would be, could lead to some sense of real intellectual potential, or what was the aim in the choice of the sources?
Well, we had a kind of a template, a kind of a theory of National Socialism and of the Third Reich, which we wanted to try to argue, so to speak, through the texts. That I should say, first of all. Of course, there were some texts which had to appear. You had to have selections from Mein Kampf. You had to have selections from Goebbels' 1943 Berlin speech, the so-called Sportpalast speech. There are certain things that were just inevitable that had to occur. But for example, taking the Goebbels speech for a moment, we not only included selections from the Goebbels speech, but we also included responses to the speech, women's responses to the speech, Thomas Mann's responses to the speech. So we tried to put the speech in context, put the speech in action, so to speak. And that brings me to the sort of larger theoretical frame. The way we looked at it, and I think this was our thesis, if there's such a thing in the book, is that the National Socialism, the culture of the Third Reich, had, so to speak, two or three dimensions. And the dimensions that we focused on were, first of all, what we thought of as the sublime National Socialism, and I put that in sort of ironic quotation marks, that is academic National Socialism, the work of Carl Schmitt, Alfred Bäumler, and also at the same time, there was a kind of vulgar, popular, pedestrian National Socialism, the sort of everyday, what you might call tavern National Socialism. And we wanted to try to find texts that illustrated both of those things. So that was one point. And the way we did that was by including chapters on the political religion of National Socialism, that is the famous Nuremberg rallies, the approved art of Arno Breker and Torak, the kind of Wagnerian synthesis of Christianity and pseudo-Greek or pseudo-Hellenic culture. And that includes things like racial biology, marriage requirements. That all was all part of this sort of sacred, in an anthropological sense, National Socialism. At the same time, we wanted to have, as I said, profane, vernacular National Socialism, body culture, gymnastics, psychology, fashion, travel, even popular films, unpolitical films like this film that was very popular called Lucky Kids that came out of the Goebbels film studios, Goebbels Film Factory, which we would call today a rom-com about three happy-go-lucky German young people who end up in Manhattan. I think this combination of a kind of sacred culture of National Socialism, a high culture of National Socialism, an intellectual culture of National Socialism, and a popular culture of National Socialism was the sort of overriding theme, to present both of those things together. And also to emphasize the degree to which even the most banal things, the most conventional things that we would associate with Nazism. For example, the definition of race was really an open matter in the Third Reich, that there was a consensus that race was the center of Nazi ideology, but there was no consensus about what race actually meant and how it was defined. And in fact, the most important thing was not that these things were defined and discussed, but that they were discussed, not decided on, but that there was discussion about what race meant. And that, I think, is something else we try to emphasize.
That's a very interesting point. I was just at a conference recently where Mark Roisman was talking about a book that he's putting together with Richard Wetzel on Beyond the Racial State, they want to call it. And they're arguing against that notion from Michael Burley and Vipperman about the racial science really being the foundation of the ideology and the motivation of the regime. I wanted to continue along with the question of the folk, the race, and if you could discuss perhaps how what you discovered here and what you've been telling us really, how it either, you know, would jive with what Roisman has been talking about need to get away from this notion of racial science being the be and end all of the Nazi ideology.
Well, there was, of course, racial science, but racial science never became the dominant ideology of the regime. I think they're right about that. There was also a kind of racial mysticism, a racial doctrine that was unscientific, in fact, anti-scientific, like Arthur Rosenberg. And to some extent, one finds it in other unusual places. For example, one of the texts that we emphasized was a text by Otto Hoeffler, which was focused on the ancient German race. It was a kind of anthropological text. And his argument was that the ancient Germans were, he coined the word berserkers, kind of crazed. He took the term berserkers from bearskins. Mm-hmm. And that they were intoxicated. They used various kinds of drugs and other potions to increase their sense of fanaticism and frenzy. And this was very badly received in the Third Reich. His book was very badly received because it made Germans seem less than respectable, less than upright and moral. And he was severely criticized in the official journals for having published this book and for having made these arguments. So we tried to show both sides of that controversy with the point that these things were constantly being discussed but never decided.
But at the same time, when I assume we want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, I assume that the term Volk is absolutely central and was never up for discussion. It's just a question of what Volk meant.
That's right. That's right. Just like anti-Semitism was ubiquitous and in essence never up for discussion, although there were debates about anti-Semitism as well. There were debates about who the Jews were and what constituted a legal definition of the Jews. So we included all that as well. In other words, I think the main point, and I think this is really a point that we make throughout the book, is that it was not ideology per se that welded together the Third Reich. It was the way that ideology was enacted that was important. In other words, you didn't really have to be a national socialist in the sense that you adopted a coherent ideological position to be acceptable within the framework of the Nazi elite or within Nazi society. You had to simply adopt what the Germans call a Gesinnung, an ethos or a standpoint, and that relates directly how different strands of German culture and ideology could be easily adopted and made acceptable and coordinated into the mentality of the regime. In that sense, this enactment point is crucial, because you have these events, and this is another thing we stress in the book, you have these events in which large groups of people enact their allegiance to the National Socialist State and to its precepts without saying precisely what that meant. For example, there is the vow of allegiance of the academic community in Leipzig to the regime, in which Heidegger participated, a number of other important intellectuals, the art historian Pinder participated. And this enactment of allegiance was more important than the substance of allegiance. And we tried to emphasize that. And that's, by the way, the context in which we placed Heidegger in the book, rather than as a as the rector of the university.
But did you find that that for those close to Hitler or thought they were close to Hitler, that wasn't there a more coherent concept of Weltanschauung, of worldview? I mean, it's not merely a Gesinnung. It's also has a specific systematicity to it, maybe loose. But I sometimes wonder if, you know, many people say Hitler's worldview is illogical and, you know, changed depending on the situation. But I tend to see a consistency in terms of basic structures of worldview within certainly Hitler's writing, but, you know, among leading Nazi figures.
Well, it's certainly true that Hitler's worldview and Hitler's and Mein Kampf specifically were considered to be the sort of, you know, the great central text of the regime. But what's interesting is about that is it was very rarely quoted. And when it was, when Hitler was quoted, it was generally his speeches that were quoted. He was at one point asked if he would permit an anthologized version of Mein Kampf to appear, a sort of pamphlet or shorter version to appear, and he rejected the idea. So that there never was a kind of, I think the word canonical is the right word, there was never a canonical a statement of what the worldview was. If you try to find a book called The National Socialist Worldview published during the Third Reich, it would be very difficult to find such a book. And there may be one or two examples of that, but these efforts to systematize the Folkish ideology or the National Socialist Worldview never came to anything. And that's why there was a great deal of competition among intellectuals to systematize or to try to systematize the Nazi worldview. Boimler, Heidegger, all tried, Ernst Krieg, all tried to systematize the worldview at various points, but none of those systematizations ever took. For example, central figures who were close to Hitler, as you say, like Alfred Rosenberg or Martin Bormann, they have completely diametrical positions on Christianity. Rosenberg was a pagan. He basically rejected Christianity. He was anti-Catholic. In fact, so anti-Catholic that at one point the regime had to repudiate him in order to make, in order to solidify the Concordat, the treaty with the Vatican in 1933. Rosenberg had to be sidelined because of his anti-Catholicism. And by the way, they also permitted, the regime also permitted anti-Rosenberg Catholic pamphlets to be published during the Third Reich. Bormann, on the other hand, was also anti-Christian, much closer to Hitler, but never published his anti-Christian writings. So those are examples of how the worldview existed in a sort of tacit way, but never really could become explicit or universally adopted in a doctrinal sort of way. That's why we called our chapter on ideology Between Myth and Doctrine, because the mythology never really became a full-fledged doctrine. Mm-hmm. Also, I should add, if you take a figure like Nietzsche, for example, there were enormous debates on Nietzsche, pro-Nietzsche, anti-Nietzsche, National Socialist. There are even in modern art, it's often thought that the degenerate art exhibition of 1937 solidified the regime's opposition to modern art, and it certainly did do that. But before 1937, there were very important examples of pro-modern art National Socialists. Goebbels himself was one of them, and promoted some expressionist painters before 1937, and even hosted Goebbels even hosted the visit of the futurist Filippo Marinetti to Berlin, where Marinetti gave a series of lectures.
I was interested to hear in the, is it Creek, the one philosopher
right.
that you had cited there, discussions about Ernst Haeckel, because I have a particular interest in Ernst Haeckel. Some people, certainly Daniel Gassman, some years ago argued that Haeckel's evolutionary worldview was quite important for founding the Nazi worldview. And, I mean, certainly terms like unwertes Leben or Leben unwertes Leben, I think, originate with Haeckel. But it was interesting to me to see somebody like Creek say that we finally overcome this Haeckelian biology in defining the folk and defining philosophy. So it was interesting that, it is such an open topic, folk.
Again, discussed but never decided. I think that's the right way of putting it.
Yeah, and I suppose even with Galen, where he says that the emergence of the concept of folk has provided a new framework for German philosophy. I mean, there's even that potential to accept, I suppose, irrationality within the philosophy. Just by saying it's the important thing is it's emanating from the folk, and that can be then left to be decided what that is. So I wanted to ask something, since we're talking about these core doctrines and so on, the sort of antinomy to folk is the Jew, right? The Jewry.
Right.
I think at some point you say that anti-Semitism is the core doctrine.
Yes, we do.
Of Nazism. Could you just say a bit more about that?
Well, even there, if you think about it, there are different kinds of anti-Semitism and different enactments of anti-Semitism and different ways that anti-Semitism is adopted. For example, using that framework of the sublime sacred national socialism, the SS adopted a very, as is well known, a very strict definition of the Jew as the enemy, the Jewish enemy of the folk. And the SS view was that the Jews not only represented a race that had to be eliminated from Germany, but a race that had to be eliminated from the face of the earth. And this is not universally found in all Nazi variants of anti-Semitism. You have what you might call a much more pedestrian, prosaic national socialism, anti-Semitism in the Third Reich, for example, Jews being refused admission to swimming pools, Jews being refused, not being permitted to sit on park benches, Jews not being permitted to own pets. These kinds of eliminationist laws, you might call them, are of a different magnitude of the SS racial theory and SS anti-Semitism. So we tried to present also different versions of that as well, of anti-Semitism having different characteristics and not being just one kind of anti-Semitism.
And so the again, just to bring up this whole question of the irrationality or the complexity of Nazi ideology, the opportunism of Nazi ideology, it seems that with the concepts of folk and the Jew, there's not too much variance. I mean, in other words, sure, they're opportunistic when they roll it out, but it seems that you're arguing that it's absolutely core.
Absolutely. That's right. And the folk community is a central concept that is universal to Nazi ideology. But as you rightly say, the way these things were instrumentalized was opportunistic and often at variance with each other. And I think that's very important also. By the way, there's one thing we come back to the question of how we chose texts?
Yes, yes.
Because there's something I wanted to say, which I forgot. We chose texts also because of the way they revealed or made transparent how politics and ideology were staged. What I mean by that is that we emphasized the choreography of certain events, how these events were not only received, but how they were disseminated, how they were mounted. I'll give you an example. One of the most unusual texts that we have, text that I've never seen, I'm almost certain was never published elsewhere, is a text by the mayor of Nuremberg discussing how the Nuremberg rallies were staged, were how they were mounted, how they were funded, and what it meant for the city to have millions of people descend on it annually for one event in the year, what it did to the character of the city of Nuremberg. It's certainly not an anti-Nazi document, but it reveals something about the way the Nuremberg rallies were mounted that other documents don't reveal. We also do something, we have a section on the discussion of the importance of the swastika, how the swastika was disseminated, not just as a symbol, but also as a text, the textual basis of the swastika. We do a lot with holidays, with rituals, with posters, posters being very important in the iconography of the Third Reich. So a lot of what we do is to, we have a lot of material on how speakers were trained for meetings, how propaganda tours were organized. And also we have some examples, sort of humorous examples of how these things could misfire. For example, we have one text which talks about how Robert Ley, who was the head of the labor front, delivered a speech about alcohol abuse while being visibly intoxicated.
Mm-hmm. I saw that. Thinking about your teacher George Moss's collection from the 60s, there were many texts in there that I suppose, I don't know how to put it exactly, they almost invited the reader in. Like there's that text, very interesting text, The Essay Man's Bride, by Gudrun Streiter, which I use with my students. But it sort of suggests the...
Hi.
Do you hear me?
I know, I lost you there.
Okay, I'm sorry. I was referring to the type of text that George Mosse chose. Some of those texts, I remember, invited the reader really into, participate perhaps in the what it was that people found so fascinating with the Nazi ideology. There's a text, the Essay Man's Bride. I don't know if you remember that
one. Yes, of course.
And it seemed that with your choice of text that you maybe were not doing that, inviting the readers in to, experience the thrill of the Nazi movement. I don't know if that's a fair characterization.
Well, we do have a few texts that do that, but it wasn't our central focus. That's right. I mean, we have some things about, for example, youth meetings, what it was like to be a member of the Hitler Youth. We do have some of that.
The reason I brought it up is I wanted to address something else, which was the in the introductions are I think excellent for the readers to really familiarize themselves with some. Both historiographical debates, but also helping them to approach the particular texts that you offer. But I think there's a very strong tone of not necessarily warning, but you seem to be eager to make sure that the readers are not falling for these texts, if I can put it that way. I'm thinking about again compared to George Moss's introductions. They tend to not be as condemning of the texts in certain ways as your introductions. And I'm just curious if I'm right in seeing it that way, and if so, why it was that you chose to present the texts in that fashion.
Well, I think there was a sense among both of us as editors, but also on the part of the press, that it was necessary to make clear that this was not only a scholarly work, but a work with moral, with a moral dimension, and that it was certain that it was certainly not extolling the virtues of Nazism, but also pointing to the pointing explicitly to the dangers and the threat that this kind of ideology carries with it. And so I think you're right. I think we did try to make explicit that this was a book about a criminal genocidal regime, and that we were demonstrating how this regime worked, and we encouraged students to think about it in that way rather than to immerse themselves in the ideology without thinking about what its ultimate function was.
Yeah, and I, as somebody who teaches in a provincial university in Northern Ireland, you know, I certainly understand the need to do that, because when I teach German history, I often ask the students in the very first lecture, I say, so how many of you own a copy of Mein Kampf? And I only learned to ask that question because students told me they had it. And, you know, inevitably, two, three, four raise their hands, usually men. And I ask them why they have it, and they say, well, I just wanted to know what Hitler thought. You know, but it's... Right. There's that sort of you know, fascination and a kind of fetishization of the Nazis that a lot of students bring to it. So you know, in that sense, I certainly understand why it's important maybe to preface these texts with that type of you know, interpretation or warning or something.
I hope we didn't do too much of that, but we did do that very self-consciously at certain points, because we felt that it was necessary to create this distance between the reader and the text rather than to allow the reader just to simply absorb the text or be absorbed into the text.
Yeah, no, I definitely saw it at several points, but it really, as I was mentioning, you know, when I opened the book, I was feeling the heaviness of the period, and those introductions spoke to that for me. So, you know, so that I, as a reader, I wasn't bothered certainly by that. But it, you know, it definitely does. There is a contrast between the way that you introduce texts and, say, the other collections we've mentioned introduces texts in that regard.
Right, I think that's right.
Also connected to this, perhaps, I think you mentioned this in the introduction, and I don't remember the wording exactly, but, you know, you chose not to bring in some of those voices that we mentioned at the beginning from the Weimar source book, maybe Adorno, Hannah Arendt, figures that are in exile, but nonetheless, let's say, processing the regime, certainly writing critically about it. Why is it that those voices, you know, they appear a bit, but you chose not to highlight them?
Well, I think that the most obvious reason is that if we included texts by exiles, which we thought about, have a section on the exile voices, would have expanded the book to twice its size. Mm-hmm. And the book was already 1,000 pages, and we were way over our limit. So we didn't do that. And we did include, as you mentioned, some voices. Thomas Mann appears 3 times. Leon Feuchtwanger appears. Manfred Georg, who was the editor of the Aufbau, the exile newspaper in New York, appears a couple of times. But we wanted to have exile voices that responded or intervened to, in specific contexts. So Thomas Mann's response to Goebbels' speech, Feuchtwanger's response to the Aryanization, quote-unquote, of his apartment, Manfred Georg's response to Nazi writing about American film. So that these responses would not be sort of general reflections on anti-Semitism or theoretical statements about anti-Semitism or racism or Nazism, but specific responses, specific interventions in debates. We have, for example, the very... A largely unknown but very important book on Nazi propaganda written by Willy Münzenberg in Paris. Willy Münzenberg was this sort of chief communist anti-fascist in Europe at that time, also in exile. We have something from Wilhelm Reich's Mass Psychology of Fascism. So things that were influential in the period, would be the criteria, rather than things that we now think are important, but were not important or considered to be important then. For example, Hannah Arendt, for all the virtues of what she wrote after 1945, really was completely unknown before 1945. And that was another important criteria.
Mm-hmm. So just to, as a sort of, I guess I'm coming towards the end of my questions, but in the process of editing this book, collecting the sources, reading through, I mean, you've obviously worked through an enormous amount of material that most historians don't go through that amount of, especially probably senior historians go through that amount of source material sifting through. How did it change? What did you learn, I suppose, in the course of putting together the book? Any sort of final insight, something, maybe documents that you found revealing that you didn't know earlier, or how did it change your thesis going in?
Well, let me say that the thing that I found most surprising that I learned editing this book and going through the various collections of sources and documents that we used and archives that we used in finding these materials is the extent to which the regime was self-conscious about measuring and monitoring and keeping track of the responses to its propaganda efforts. Hmm. We have, for example, two documents reporting the results of survey research on radio listeners. We have an extraordinary document, an archival document, asking women how they spent their free time while they were members of the Strength Through Joy movement, what they did during their free time, which is very, very revealing in ways that one would not expect. There's an extraordinary document called Good and Bad Posters, which is a critical reading of two posters used in the elections of 1932, demonstrating the weaknesses of one of the posters and the successes of the other. So that we were unprepared, I think, for the extent to which the regime monitored its own efforts and was conscious of its own political propaganda techniques. That I think, needs to be said. I think also we were surprised, maybe not so surprised, but certainly surprised to some extent by the range of expressions of the Nazi worldview, which we talked about. Mm-hmm. The range of mentalities, the dissonances, the way that the party did not prescribe ideological coherence, preferring instead incoherence to ideological coherence. That sort of goes against the grain of thinking about Nazism, which always is imagined to be ideologically coherent, or at least promoting ideological coherence. It goes against the sort of idea of Hannah Arendt and many others that totalitarianism was about creating a kind of ideological or historical consistency. She uses the word consistency a lot. And we found that the Nazi regime was anything but consistent, most often inconsistent, and they preferred it that way. So I think those are two things that we learned and changed our understanding of the epoch.
Very good. Before I ask you a sort of final question about what you're working on now, is there anything else you'd like to tell listeners about the book?
Well, yeah, there's one other thing we haven't discussed. There's a big difference, I think, in the book between the way that we treat the Nazi regime and the way that we treat the victims of Nazism. We do have a lot of material on gays, the handicapped, asocials, Sinti. That should be mentioned. And also that the Holocaust section of the book shifts gears dramatically in the sense that there we have a rather substantial number of texts by victims rather than by perpetrators. That section of the book deals with some of the major quandaries, and important for students, major quandaries in dealing with the Holocaust. For example, the role of the Jewish councils and the famous debate about whether the Jewish councils contributed to or didn't contribute to the destruction of their own people. And we included many, many Jewish voices, diary excerpts and statements that would allow students to discuss the issues involved in assessing the circumstances and limits of choice available to the Jewish councils in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, there were a lot of, especially that section was very, you know, text I hadn't seen before, and certainly, you know, extremely moving, disturbing testimonies from the, I think there's one with a Czech prisoner or a guard or both that you include there.
Yes, that's right.
I think we've managed to touch on some of the important issues in this, you know, as I said, just very impressive book that is going to be really tremendously useful for an entire community of historians and scholars, I'm sure, for many years. So congratulations on that achievement.
Thank you.
The sort of final question we like to ask in these podcasts is just to have scholars say something about what they're now working on now, and what the, you know, either what has come out of this book in terms of new research, or perhaps you're working on something completely different.
Well, I think what I'm doing now certainly relates to this book and comes out of this book to some extent, but is also moving in a slightly different direction. What I'm doing is trying to write a book about how historical concepts are formed in the 20th century and what concepts are unique to the 20th century. I mean, political concepts. And the concepts that I've chosen are genocide, totalitarianism, and total war. And I'm trying to write about not just when and how these concepts were invented, so to speak, but why they were invented and what the conditions are under which they were invented. And also, lastly, how they were different from concepts invented in the 19th century, concepts like progress, revolution, dialectic. How do 20th century concepts differ? How do they embody the the events of the 20th century in the very formation of those concepts.
That sounds like a fascinating book. I mean, myself, I'm interested in the future of working on a book on just one term, Weltanschauung, which really does span the 19th and the 20th centuries.
Right.
Those three sound like fascinating topics, especially if you are comparing them to the 19th century conceptions of history. Well, you know, we look forward to that, and perhaps we can have another interview at some point later on when that project is finished. Okay, well, Anson, thanks so much for the time and the thoughts.
And thank you for having me.